Three things in human life are important. The first is to be kind. The second is to be kind. The third is to be kind. So that's Henry James, the novelist. And I think in a way we could paraphrase that as three things in the spiritual life are important. The first is to act with metta. The second is to act with metta. The third is to act with metta. So in this talk, I'm going to draw quite a bit on Sangracchita Bhante's commentary on the Metta Sutta called Living with Kindness. And I'll give you various quotes of it. At the end of it, it's a very lovely commentary. At the end of it, he says, "The way of metta is not only a path of ever-increasing positive emotion leading to enlightenment, it is a guide to recovering our basic human inheritance of joy." So yes, so metta is a path to enlightenment. It's a way to the goal of awakening, as well as an expression of the goal. But it's also about recovering our human inheritance. I like that very much. It's an expression of our basic humanity. So in other words, to be really human is to be kind. So what I'm going to do in this talk is I will talk a bit about metta as a path and expression of the goal. But before that, I'm going to talk a bit about what is metta, and then I'm going to look at three applications of metta. And just to manage your expectations, I'm going to be talking for about an hour, so you know, you can just settle into your cushions or chair. I'd just like to make a little disclaimer first as well. So you might think that I'm a love type, a metta type. But I have to say, I've always struggled with the metta bhavana. And even now, if you say, would you like to do the metta bhavana or the mindfulness of breathing? It's mindfulness of breathing every time. So you might then wonder how come I've developed a course and written a book on metta. Well, the short answer is because I was asked to do so. So about 7 years ago, I'd had a sabbatical, and when I came back, a good friend of mine, Maitreya Bandhu, asked me if I would develop a course based on metta as a follow-on course to the mindfulness courses. Singamata, you mentioned that we have this thing, Breathing Space, at the London Buddhist Centre, where we teach mindfulness for depression, addiction, stress, anxiety, and so on. So I've been very involved in that, and I could see it was a good idea. And although I don't claim to be good at it, I feel very strongly that metta is important. So as we know, mindfulness has become very, very popular in the wider world outside of the Buddhist world, and I think that's had an effect certainly on our own community on upping our practice of mindfulness, which perhaps wasn't always the case. When back in 1991, there was an order member called Amrita Vajra who gave a talk: "Is there mindfulness in the order?" And kind of the implication was, "No, there isn't." Which is sort of a bit surprising, or from the sound of it, a bit surprising, because our teacher, Bhante, is very mindful, but certainly then his disciples perhaps lacked some mindfulness. I think with the, particularly with the introduction of the sort of mindfulness courses for depression and so on, I think that had a quite helpful influence. And we've got, for example, Maitreya Bandhu's book, Life with Full Attention, which sort of brings that fully back into our own tradition. And one of the things that I think is very strong in the mindfulness course is the importance of mindfulness both on and off the cushion. And so when I was thinking about developing a course on metta, I wanted to have that emphasis as well. So metta in daily life. as well as doing the actual metta bhavana meditation practice, because I think they mutually reinforce each other. So I called the course Kindness Behaviour Training, because KBT, because it seems in that world you have to have a little set of letters, MBCT, MBRP, MBAR, MBSR, so KBT. With an emphasis on practicing metta in daily life, hence the behaviour. In the book, in the course, what I look at is, in a way, what metta, what kindness is and it isn't, and look at some of how we practice metta in our daily lives. So the book, Mindful Emotion, is in effect a course book, which came out of developing this course, looking at, well, it just goes through different ways of practicing the metta, how to put it into our lives, as well as downloads, so you can listen to my dulcet tones leading you through meditation. So that's a little advert, so you can just get that over with. So what is metta? So again, coming back to Bhante's commentary, he says, developed to its full intensity, metta is a down-to-earth care and concern directed to all living beings equally, individually and without reservation. The unfailing sign of metta is that you are deeply concerned for the well-being, happiness and prosperity of the object of your metta. So it's this very strong concern for beings. So it's something that's active, it's not just a feeling. He also says, metta is love that breaks out of the narrow confines of self-referential selectivity. Love that does not have a preference, non-exclusive love. If we're going to use the word love at all, we could describe metta as disinterested love. It is, of course, interested in the sense of concerned. It is not uninterested, but it is disinterested in the sense that when you feel it, you have no thought of what you might get back in return. So it's a non-exclusive love that doesn't expect anything in return. So in other words, metta is a very, very high ideal. Now, we often leave metta untranslated because, so we talk about the metta bhavana, because we're wanting to convey what it really is. So any translation is problematic. But it's also, of course, a bit problematic leaving it untranslated, because I think metta can sound a bit cool as a word. I'm afraid one of my little bugbears is when I get a little card from someone signed metta, sort of, instead of, I'd just rather they said love or best wishes or even kind regards somehow than metta. But anyway, that's just a little personal preference. I hope nobody's troubled by that. So we often translate it as loving kindness. In a way, love has a stronger emotional resonance, but of course it's also a rather vague word. I mean, I love chocolate, but probably that's not metta. In the book, I've used, the Mindful Emotion, the subtitle is A Short Course in Kindness. It's Kindness Behaviour Training. So I use the word kindness, which to me, again, has strong resonances, but again, it can be a bit sentimental, a bit like love. When I was doing a talk and a PowerPoint presentation on KBT, so I Googled images for kindness, and the sort of things that came up were like a little kitten with a fluffy chick, and I'm afraid that is not metta, that is sentimentality. Although I remember when I gave the talk, at least one person sort of seeing the picture of the kitten with the chick. Anyway, to me that's not kindness. So we've had the word kindness a long time in the English language. It goes back before 900 years in the Common Era. It comes from the Old English word gekind. I don't know if that's how it's pronounced. My Old English isn't up to it. But anyway, something like gekind, which means natural or native or innate. So it originally comes from the word meaning family, and the word kin comes from that. So in other words, what this seems to me to imply is that kindness is a natural state. It's the way that we might naturally be predisposed towards our family, you know, conflicts in family notwithstanding, but it's that sort of natural feelings that we might have. So yes, I chose to call it kindness rather than compassion, which is a longer and Latinate word which hasn't been around for as long, although you know, when I was looking around at what else is going on, particularly in the sort of psychology world, people tend to talk about compassion and self-compassion. So yes, I did have a look when I was developing the course at what was going on, and one of the things that I found particularly useful comes from compassion-focused therapy, which is the work of Paul Gilbert, who's a professor of psychology in Derby. And he draws on evolutionary psychology, and apparently according to evolutionary psychology, we have three main emotional regulation systems, which is the threat system, the drive system, and the soothing system. So the threat system is basically a system that looks out for danger. And if it's easily triggered, and if we get a sense of danger, then in humans at least we get a response of anger or fear or disgust or a sort of desire to submit. The sort of strap line of the threat system is better safe than sorry. So, you know, if you think of gazelles on the savannah and a lion or a sense of a lion appears, the gazelle can't think, oh, excuse me, I'm just having my lunch, munching away at the grass, and I'll deal with this later. So, no, of course, the gazelle runs straight away. Just as, you know, we cross the road, and if we suddenly realise there's a bus coming towards us, we move rather than finish our conversation that we might be having with our other Buddhist friend that we're having a slow walk across the road with. So that's the threat system. Then there's the drive system. So the drive directs us towards and motivates us towards goals. So it can be simple things like food or sex, but also more complex things like passing an exam, getting a job. And when we get our goal, we get a little boost of pleasure, which is mediated via dopamine. And then the third system, the soothing system, so what you have is a change in evolutionary strategy. So whereas reptiles produce lots of offspring and then just let them get on with it, what you have in warm-blooded animals is that they produce fewer offspring, but they look after them. And this looking after is mediated by the soothing system. So it's particularly associated with oxytocin, which is sometimes called the cuddle chemical, because when you cuddle someone, you get a release of oxytocin. It's also, oxytocin is released in lactation. So when a mother is feeding her infant and sort of bonding with her infant, then oxytocin helps to mediate that bonding between mother and child. But it also, sometimes called the affiliation system, because it also helps bonding more widely. So humans, of course, are social animals, and it helps create those sort of bonds. So we've got those three systems, but then in humans, it does get a bit more complicated, because as well as those sort of three emotion systems, what you have in humans is this complex higher functions of the mind, which allow us to do wonderful things like write talks on iPads, or even for some people, build things like iPads. But also allow us to imagine, for example, catastrophic outcomes. So, for example, if we go back to the gazelle for a moment, running off from the lion, and supposing the gazelle gets away, might just shake a bit afterwards to release what's happened. But as far as I'm aware, gazelles don't go, oh, that was such a close call. Do you know, I was nearly lunch then, and I'm never going to go back to that oasis again. It's like really dangerous. Whereas we can, you know, we can endlessly go over all sorts of horrible imagined scenarios and get ourselves more and more caught up. So we can, you know, the threat system can get activated very easily, and then our mind, our ruminating mind, can just keep it going so that we get completely stuck in that threat system. So I find it useful as just a kind of a sort of heuristic, this idea of the three emotional regulation system, partly so that the book's called Mindful Emotion, partly to be mindful of what emotion is going on. One of the compassion-focused therapists that I really like is someone called Mary Welford, and she talks about them as being like three apps. So it's like they're different phone apps. But so the thing is, you need to know which app is running. Because if the wrong app is running, you can get yourself into trouble, as I'll mention later. The other thing I like about it, this thing, is that so kindness, compassion is, I think, particularly associated with the soothing and affiliation system. And in a way, what that implies to me is that we've got the kit for kindness. It's there, it's there built into us. Now, it may not be very well developed, particularly if we have an over active threat system, but nevertheless, it is present. And in a way, we can think of cultivating metta as more allowing that to come more fully online, rather than having to, you know, go digging in the garden or wherever it is to try and unearth some few little feelings of metta. It's kind of something that's already there. So I'm going to move on to some applications now. I'm going to look at communication, particularly digital communication and kindness in that, to have a bit of a look at self-metta and a bit at forgiveness. So, first of all, communication. So as we know, communication is hard. It's very easy to miss each other in communication. It's very easy to sort of be just on a different place, different planet, as it were, and we sort of just don't catch each other. I was reminded of this with a poem I quite like by Billy Collins, where you get a sense of Billy feeling that the vet, in this case, was not getting him, was not on the same thing. So I'll read you the poem. It's called Putting Down the Cat. The assistant holds her on the table, the fur hanging limp from her tiny skeleton. And the veterinarian raises a needle of fluid which will put the line through her ninth life. Painless, he reassures me, like counting backwards from 100. But I want to tell him that our poor cat cannot count at all, much less to 100. Much less backwards. So yeah, you get this sense of just being on different wavelengths. The Buddha said that we're born with an axe in our mouth. Quite a vivid metaphor. In a way implying how with our unskillful speech, how we can so easily harm ourselves. And I might add, harm others too. I was thinking that in the digital age, it's a bit more like we're born with axes in our fingertips. And when I was thinking about this, I was, if any of you have seen the Marvel superhero movie Logan, so what you get with Logan, for those of you who've seen him, is it's like, and he has all these claws that spring out of his fingers. And I think we're a bit like that. We've sort of wielded this much bigger power through the, you know, the digital means, much more than just sort of purely verbal. Now, fortunately, although obviously the Buddha didn't tell us how to do digital communication, he did give us some good advice on communication. There's a nice little sutta with Prince Abhaya. So the background to this is that someone put up Prince Abhaya to try and catch out the Buddha. People seem to quite like doing that, see if they could catch out the Buddha. So what this person did is said to Prince Abhaya, what you need to do is ask the Buddha whether he would use speech that is unwelcome and disagreeable to others. And if the Buddha says yes, he would, then you just say, oh, well, you're just like an ordinary person then. And if he says no, then you would say, well, why did you speak to David Datta in a way that he found unwelcome? So the backstory being that David Datta wanted to be the next leader of the Sangha, and the Buddha said no. So Abhay trots off to see the Buddha and puts his question to the Buddha. Of course, the Buddha's not caught out that easily, and he just says, well, look, it's a complex area. You can't just say yes or no. And what he does instead is give some criteria for skillful communication. So he says, first of all, communication needs to be truthful, which would seem self-evident, perhaps. Secondly, it needs to be beneficial. So even if it's true and it's welcome, if it's not beneficial, the Buddha doesn't say it. I'm thinking maybe, for example, of flattery. There might be some flattery which is actually true and very welcome, but having a flattering effect that's perhaps not beneficial. But the third criterion is that the Buddha says that he finds the right time. So regardless of whether the speech is welcome and agreeable or unwelcome and disagreeable, so he might say something that's unwelcome and disagreeable, but as long as it's true and beneficial, he'll find the right time to say it. So I think that's really worth bearing those things in mind, and particularly bearing them in mind in terms of digital communication. So I've already alluded to, in a way, digital communication makes communication more powerful because it has a bigger reach. So, first of all, truthful. It shouldn't need saying, but of course we're very familiar with things like fake news nowadays. And, you know, as somebody who worked, well, until a week ago, in the National Health Service, I was very pained by the promise of $350 million going to the NHS prior to the Brexit vote, and then magically not disappearing as soon as the vote had gone, which isn't to comment about the outcome of the vote, but just it was just a bald lie, but had a big effect because of mass media. The other thing about digital communication is we have less data about the recipients. So I was struck by this just by an incident that happened on the stairs, which didn't happen actually face to face, but as you'll see, that made me think. So what happened is I was at home, and one of the guys I lived with said to somebody else, "Are you in for dinner?" And the other guy said, "No." And the first guy said, "Oh, good." Now, perhaps I think because he saw the pained or at least confused face of the other person, the first guy said, "Oh, no, it's just I wanted to know because I'm cooking tonight, so I just need to know who's in for dinner." And also, of course, I knew, and probably the other guy knew as well, actually, that this guy hates cooking. So it's like, oh, great, one less person to cook for. Now, if that hadn't happened face-to-face, you could easily see how a misunderstanding could have occurred there in that situation. And I don't know about you, but I've certainly had texts, particularly in the perhaps earlier stage of romance when I don't know the person so well, when I thought, is this humour or is this person having a go at me? So emoticons notwithstanding, I think it can sometimes be ambiguous. It can be dangerous. So yeah, and I think the other thing, because we don't have information about the people receiving our communication, it's harder to practice empathy, it's harder to be empathic. As when we're face-to-face, it's much easier to modify our responses depending how the other people is responding to what we're saying. We pick up a lot non-verbally. But when we're communicating digitally, we're rather alienated from our audience. We can feel almost a bit invulnerable safe in our bedroom or wherever it is that we're sending the email or other thing, and perhaps end up saying things that we wouldn't actually say face to face. So I've got four recommendations for digital communication. So first of all, check your sources. It's so easy to pass on misinformation. So I think that's really important. Check your sources. Secondly, check your motivation. So which app is running? Are you really in the soothing affiliation, or actually are you in the threat and sort of feeling, you know, being motivated by anger or the reward, you know, the desire to sort of get one over the other person or appear clever? I mean, it's just so natural. I mean, it's not to be come down on us very strongly. It's just to notice what's going on, because, as I say, it's just very natural. We have this inbuilt desire to, you know, to want to be appear clever or to get one over the other person. Again, I was reminded of a Billy Collins poem, which I'll read you, mostly because I like, but I think it also illustrates this sort of natural state in a way. It's called Child Development. As sure as prehistoric fish grew legs and sauntered off the beaches into forests, working up some irregular verbs for their first conversation, so 3-year-old children enter the phase of name-calling. Every day, a new one arrives and is added to the repertoire. You dumb goopy head. You big sewer face. You poop on the floor. A kind of Navajo ring to that one. They yell from knee level, their little mugs flushed with challenge. Nothing Samuel Johnson would bother tossing out in a pub, but then the toddlers are not trying to devastate some fatuous enlightenment hack. They're just tormenting their fellow squirts, or going after the attention of the giants, way up there with their cocktails and bad breath, talking baritone nonsense to the other giants, waiting to call them names after thanking them for the lovely party and hearing the door close. The mature save their hot-head invective for things, an errant hammer, tire chains, or receding trains missed by seconds, that they know in their adult hearts, even as they threaten to banish Timmy to bed for his appalling behaviour, that their bosses are big fatty stupids, their wives are dopey dope heads, and that they themselves are Mr. Sillypants. So yeah, it's just like, that's what we have, isn't it? You know, that's what we have, and we just need to be honest about it and make sure that that threat system is not in operation when we communicate digitally. Third thing is to reflect on how is this likely to be received? Could it be misinterpreted? Again, it can be, you know, we've got such a clear in our own mind that it can be very easy to think, well, of course, they will get what I'm saying. But it doesn't always happen that way. I mean, I had this lovely text from a friend, which I think, again, another element of the texting, of course, is this thing where, you know, it guesses what word you want and puts it in, and then if you don't check it, you end up with nonsense. So I had this text from a friend saying, "Can I borrow your bike stop?" So I texted back, "Yes, do you mean bicycle or pump?" And the reply I got was, "Yes." So clearly my friend knew what he meant and thought it would be obvious that it was actually ambiguous. Now, you know, that was fine, it was a friend and, you know, we could laugh about it. But again, it's so easy to think that because I'm clear about what I mean by this, that the other person will, and not look for possible ambiguity in what we write. So it's really worth checking how might this be received by another person. And then fourthly, my absolute golden rule is always reread before sending. I saved myself so much pain by checking and, for example, finding that I've missed the word not, which can completely change the meaning of what you're saying. Okay, so the next area I want to look at is self-meta. So in the book, I go into a number of different approaches to self-meta because I think it is an area we can struggle with, and I'll mention two of them this evening. So, yeah, I think we can easily get into a mess with self-meta. So we come to the first stage of metabhavana, we're all keen to go, and we, okay, so meta towards the self. So we imagine the self. We sort of, you know, up comes the self. And then we can very quickly become aware of our limitations. And then we try and slurp out this other bit that goes, no, 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 you're really nice, you're lovely, you're lovely, you're lovely, love you, lovely, you love you. And meanwhile, you think, oh, but you've got, oh, and you do that, and you do that, and you do that. And then you sort of end up in this sort of battle, ruminating about, you know, what an awful person you are. But no, you're nice, really. So you can sort of, I don't know if you're familiar with that sort of thing, but it's very easy, I think, to get into that sort of a mess in a way. So I think one thing that can happen is to really try and simplify it, which is just to bring kindness to each aspect of experience as it arises. So not try and bring it to the whole of oneself, which of course, as we know, as good Buddhists, in any case, is a construct. So a thought arises, and we try and bring kindness to that. Or a painful bodily sensation arises, we bring kindness to that. In fact, even just the act of bringing awareness is an act of kindness. And it's sometimes helpful just to remember that. In a sense, just paying attention is a way of being kind to ourselves. So that's one approach. Another approach comes from a rather nice story from the Pali Canon of King Pasenadi and Queen Malika. So it seems like King Pasenadi was having a little mindful moment. He was reflecting, and he asked his wife, he said, Malika, who to you is the dearest person in the world? Now, if you haven't read any further than this, at least what happens in my mind is I imagine that he thinks Malika's going to say, you, Pasenadi, you are the dearest person to me in the world. But she doesn't. She says, me, I'm the dearest person to me in the world. And good for Pasenadi, because he doesn't seem to react. And indeed, when Malika then says, what about you, Pasenadi? Who is the dearest person to you in the world? And he says, oh, it's me. I'm the dearest person to me in the world. The Buddha becomes acquainted with what's happened, and he comments that, yeah, of course, that is how we are. To each of us, we are the dearest in the world. He then goes on to say that because of that, we should, of course, act with kindness towards others. We should remember that for them, they are the dearest object, if you like, and therefore, knowing that we feel like that, that they feel like that, we should act with kindness towards them. So what this is saying is that basically we privilege ourselves, we privilege our own experience, we have a sort of natural feeling that the world revolves around me. And I think if we can just recognize that and tune into that in a way, we can just see it as in a way that is a desire for our own good. And if we're in a relatively good state, if we're relatively psychologically healthy, that can be enough. We just recognize that actually this attention always on me, coming back to me, is a desire for my own well-being. And I can just sort of rest with that. On the other hand, if we are in not such a good state, or if we have a bit of a habit of being plagued by self-hatred, I think it is still relevant, because even self-hatred, it is a self-preoccupation. Again, it comes back to ourself. And it's often a distorted desire to be happy, often to be protective. So, you know, quite often what happens is we'll have a go ourselves, so that we almost like get in there before somebody else will have a go at us. So it sort of is somehow, peculiarly, is protective. So if we can connect to that sort of, in a way, protective function, that sort of self, almost obsession, if you like, then it's possible to even turn self-hatred into a recognition that actually at some point, in some way, we do desire our own good. We do desire to be happy. It may be that we need to dig a bit deeper to get to that, but it's there if we look deep enough. So the third area I want to look at is responding to hurt. So first of all, responding to our own hurt. So what happens when we get hurt? Well, of course, the very strong temptation, the sort of natural response, is to want to blame. We want to find somebody or something to blame. Or we fall into self-pity. And often with the blame, we jump into righteous indignation. Again, that's so tempting to do, righteous indignation. And then the other thing that we can do, certainly I've noticed in myself, is that we then sort of can flaunt our hurt to get a bit of sympathy. So, you know, you go and say, oh, do you know what that happened to me? Do you know how they responded to me? And other people go, oh, that's terrible. And yeah, it was really hard. It was really hard. So we sort of, make the most mileage we can out of our hurt, or we can do. However, the Buddha was very clear, that's not a good idea. So what the Buddha said was, those who entertain such thoughts as he abused me, he beat me, he conquered me, he robbed me, will not still their hatred. So in other words, it doesn't actually work. It doesn't work for us, it doesn't work for other people. And the Buddha goes on to say, not by hatred are hatreds ever pacified here in the world. They are pacified by love. This is the eternal law. So I think, unfortunately, it's very easy to get into quite a sort of fixed, reinforcing cycle where something happens, we feel hurt, and then quite naturally we sort of want to blame or we fall into pity, and then we just sort of ruminate upon that. I don't know if you've ever done that thing of reasons to be angry, and you start in your mind listing all the reasons why you should be angry. And then we sort of get into nursing a grudge against some other person or the world. And of course, that just creates more pain. It creates what I think of as a sort of hardening of the heart. And we end up just staying in victim mode, which unfortunately is not self-metta, even though it can have quite a strong pull, be quite an alluring sort of place to be. So my suggestion is that really the only solution to getting out of this is forgiveness, which is really about bringing metta to the situation. Now, of course, that doesn't mean pretending a hurt hasn't happened. It doesn't mean condoning or approving of other people's unskillful behaviour. As Bhante says, feeling metta does not blind you to the facts. If someone is greedy or stupid, you see that they are. But with metta, you can always see through that greed or stupidity to the beauty of the human being. It is through metta that you can hold the two together, the ugly truth and the beautiful reality. And Lewis Smead says, to forgive is to set a prisoner free and to discover that the prisoner was you. So I find that very striking, in a way, that forgiveness is a way of releasing oneself. And there have been quite a few studies done on forgiveness, and they show that if you practice forgiveness, you're less likely to experience anxiety, depression, to get caught up in substance misuse. You're likely to experience greater emotional stability and life satisfaction, and it even appears to be protective to the heart. There was a nice little study I discovered where got people to think about an offence, something that happened to them, and then they divide them into three groups. So one group they were asked to do a forgiving attitude, another group an angry attitude, and the third group to distract themselves. And then all three groups were distracted for 5 minutes and then invited to ruminate on the event. And what they found is that the angry and the distracted group, their blood pressure was just going up and down. You can imagine you start getting really wound up about it and your blood pressure goes up. Whereas in the forgiving group, their blood pressure fluctuations just stopped straight away and continued like that for some time afterwards. So even in quite a small little study like that, and it's not like people have been practicing forgiveness for a long time, it had an immediate sort of physiological effect. So how do we do this? How do we do forgiveness? Well, I think it's really worth recognizing, particularly if the hurt is significant, as opposed to a sort of relatively minor hurt, that it's a process that's likely to take time. Certainly my own experience of being hurt by one of my friends in a sort of quite unexpected way is that what I noticed is that I think I was able to be sort of polite and friendly, but somewhere my heart had just closed. You know, kind of like, say what you like, but the door is shut. And it took quite a lot of years to really work on that and soften and open that again. So I think there are a number of things we can do. I think first we need to reflect on the desirability of forgiveness. If we don't think it's a good idea, we won't do it. It's simple as that. We might sort of try and convince, you know, sort of go through the motions, but we won't actually do it. And it's sometimes pointed out that forgiveness is a present. It contains the word give, and I think in a way it's quite a noble thing to do, to in a way give that present of forgiving. I think the second thing is to meet the hurt with kindness, and particularly to work on a body level, because there will be, with that hurt, there will be a body level to what's going on, and to meet that with kindness. Another area that may well be important is to forgive ourselves, because often we can have some blame towards ourselves that we've, you know, got into this situation, or that we're not as forgiving as we think we should be. So it may be that before we can forgive the other person, we need to forgive ourselves. And then I think what we can do is try and seek to understand the other person. As far as I can tell, there aren't a lot of Buddhas in the world. So what that means is that people will make mistakes. You know, we're driven by craving and hatred. And one way of thinking about it is that, in a way, people are just doing the best they can, given their conditions, that they, like us, are trying to be happy and not to suffer. So I personally find that quite helpful to reflect on that, that given their conditions, they're doing the best they can. And then, finally, to act as well as we can with metta towards the other person. As Bhante famously said on a conference in Berlin, you can't always be happy, but you can always be friendly. That's something to perhaps aspire to, but we can always be friendly. So that's responding to our own hurt, but what about the hurt of other people? So of course, if somebody else is hurt, we want to respond with kindness, with sympathy and compassion. The Pali word that's often used is anukampa, which literally means to tremble with. So we sort of feel into somebody else's hurt and distress. Now, of course, one of the dangers in doing that when we meet somebody else's hurt is that we get drawn into righteous indignation. As I mentioned earlier, it's a very sort of alluring area or emotion. And then what we can end up with is moralism that's disguised as metta, a sort of unforgiving, harsh, judgmental attitude, which really doesn't help. It doesn't help the person who's suffering because it keeps them in the victim mode, so it keeps them trapped. But it also doesn't help us because although it may have a sort of feel-good, you know, you just feel great because you've got, you know, righteous indignation, I got right on my side, and actually it's almost at no cost because you're not actually being directly hurt, so you get this sort of win-win from that point of view. But actually, it just reinforces our own egoism and therefore traps us as well. So ideally, and this is the thing about when the time is right, as well as responding with compassion to someone else who's hurt, we want to help them to see things from a dharmic point of view. So part of that is the recognition that dukkha, that unsatisfactoriness, is in the nature of conditioned existence. Again, I'm not talking about saying it's okay that other people do unskillful things or condoning that, but just the simple recognition that painful things will happen in this world. And sometimes I think we can have a bit of a belief that, you know, we're practicing the Dharma now, and so bad things shouldn't happen to us. But unfortunately, that's not true. And if anything, as we become more sensitive, we may notice painful aspects of our experience more strongly. So it's partly just simply, it's an opportunity to recognize this nature of existence, but also I think trying to help others, again, when the moment's right, to just sort of nudge them towards forgiveness, because it's really only through forgiveness that there's a way out, there's an escape from that trap. So lastly, I want to talk a bit about metta as the path and goal, path to insight and the goal. So again, in Bhante's commentary, he says, to miss the link between metta and insight is to miss the point of metta entirely. So quite a strong statement. We know it's easy to think of the metta bhavana as like a beginner's, you know, practice. You maybe do it the first or second week you come along to the Buddhist center, and then you've done that a few times. Tick, right, I've done that, and I'll go on to something more interesting. But no, he's saying it's key to insight. So in terms of insight, we often tend to think in cognitive terms. So we think in terms of the three lakshanas, of impermanence, insubstantiality, painful nature of reality, and that obviously is very, very helpful, it's very clear. But I think what it does is it risks underplaying the affective and volitional sides, because seeing the nature of reality in terms of seeing the three lakshanas is not merely a cool appraisal of, oh yes, things are unsatisfactory. And Bhante suggests, you know, insight may not even be experienced cognitively at all. So he says, even the deepest insight need not be experienced cognitively. That is, it need not take the form of a logical proposition. You simply live it, experience it as a fully developed positivity and selflessness that is neither emotional nor cognitive. So in a way, when we're thinking about insight, the sort of central delusion, the key delusion, is we have this sense of a fixed self, this, you know, as I already mentioned, this, we see ourselves as having a self that is the centre of the universe. And the practice of metta, of course, erodes that. To the extent that it's unconditional, metta doesn't preference the self, ourself. To the extent that we feel love for all beings, which is what metta is aiming at, we go beyond this self-other distinction. It becomes ego-less. And again, Bhante, he says, if you're able to act out of metta, if you treat others just as you treat yourself, you're acting as if the distinction you unthinkingly create in your mind between yourself and others simply did not exist. In doing so, you free yourself from the power of the illusion of a separate self. And then the other thing that metta erodes is the desire for retaliation. So in a way, when something painful happens to us, that's a real test of our metta in terms of insight. You know, in a way, it's easy to love everybody when they don't impinge upon you, when they're at a nice, safe distance. But when they become a nuisance and start doing things you don't like, then it becomes a real test, that is. And I think, you know, as I was talking about forgiveness earlier, in a way, in that we get a taste of what metta is really like in terms of giving up this desire to retaliate, which is why I think it's such an important spiritual practice. You know, forgiveness is a practice of metta. when we're facing hurt that goes beyond our normal ways we think of ourselves. So the Buddha created the Sangha, as we know, and clearly that was at least in part to pass on his understandings of the nature of reality, out of his desire for the benefit of beings, out of anukampa. But I think we could say a bit more than that, which is we could think of metta as being the fabric of the universe, in the sense that metta is a natural response when we understand how things really are. And when we practice metta with others who are practicing metta, it will create quite naturally lead to friendship and create sangha. And as our metta deepens in terms of insight, it will also deepen our friendships and the level of sangha. I mean, the beautiful thing about practicing sangha is we get to be involved with other people who you wouldn't otherwise choose to be involved with. I mean, if I think of the number of people I've lived with who I wouldn't have otherwise chosen to have lived with, but we're trying to do this thing together, and in a way that forces me to go beyond myself, go beyond my preferences. And the Sangha gives us an opportunity for a vital and intensive interaction with each other if we choose to engage in that way, which you don't get with digital communication. So it's a wonderful test of our metta, an opportunity to practice metta in terms of insight, because of course the Sangha is imperfect. So when we see that the Sangha is imperfect and we experience that, it's not people aren't behaving how we think they should behave and we don't like it, then there's a real opportunity to go beyond our preferences, to see in a way the conditioned nature of other people, to try and understand them more deeply, to go beyond ourselves, which is what insight is about. So I'm just going to end with an image. This comes from the story of the Buddha as he's gaining enlightenment, particularly the Lalita Vistra. So the Buddha-to-be is sitting under the Bodhi tree just before he's enlightened, and Mara attacks. So Mara is a personification of greed, hatred, and delusion. And in the story, in the image, Mara throws arrows and other weapons and rocks and so on at the Buddha-to-be. And as these hit the halo of the Buddha, they're transformed into flowers, which then drop to the ground. So I think in a way that's quite a lovely image for metta. You could say that what metta does is takes what is difficult and painful and transforms it into something beautiful. Certainly when we're in a mental state of metta, we see the world more beautifully, as being more beautiful. And one of the traditional fruit of practicing metta is that we appear more beautiful. If you think an angry face tends to be a rather ugly face, whereas a metta-full face is a more beautiful face. So, as we know, there are a lot of arrows in the world. One only has to open the newspapers. I live in London, where, of course, have been things going on recently. There are a lot of arrows in the world, so let us make flowers.